This episode was originally recorded July 26th, 2020. Hello and welcome to
SF3.
Yes, SF3, a podcast where we review science fiction audiobooks, accompanied by the distant barking of bored corgis. That's not actually a particularly topical joke, it's just that my dogs are in the backyard right now.
I heard that as disembarking.
Disembarking!
Wow.
It's like that's, disembodied barking.
That's an awesome pun.
Indeed. So, how's everybody doing today?
What week is this of shelter in place?
I don't know.
/ cower in your homes for your lives.
I just live on Animal Crossing.
It's a better place.
It is.
Are you socially distancing in Animal Crossing?
I am socially distanced even from myself, I think, at this point.
Oh, that's what they should do, is release the pandemic on Animal Crossing, and then everyone has to stay away from each other.
A lot of things have made it into Animal Crossing, which it's just like, this is a fantasy world. Why do we need this? So there's like masks.
That's kind of awesome.
This is not your fantasy outlet.
I mean, there's also like banking and loans and so forth. At first, I was horrified about that because it's just like, I'm entering a fantasy world to get away from all of that. But it's okay. There's no interest on the loans. And so it is fantasy.
Remember, just like they said in The Matrix, if it's too perfect, people won't believe it's true.
People reject it.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to reject reality, I guess.
I don't know. People seem to do it all the time these days.
Indeed.
You know what?
Anyway, speaking of rejecting reality, let's talk about fiction.
There's a door. Let's go through it.
Yes. Yeah. Today we are talking about The 10,000 Doors of January by Alex Harrow. 2020, narrated by January Lavoie. So who's giving us the reading from the back of the book? Anybody?
I nominate Kevin.
Okay.
I'll read it if you like. In the early 1900s, a woman embarks on a fantastical journey of self-discovery after finding a mysterious book in this captivating and lyrical debut. In a sprawling mansion filled with peculiar treasures, January Scholar is a curiosity herself. As a ward of the wealthy Mr. Locke, she feels little different from the artifacts that decorate the halls, carefully maintained, largely ignored, and utterly out of place. Then she finds a strange book, a book that carries the scent of other worlds and tells a tale of secret doors of love, adventure, and danger. Each page turn reveals impossible truths about the world, and January discovers a story increasingly entwined with her own. Lush and richly imagined, a tale of impossible journeys, unforgettable love, and the enduring power of stories awaits in Alex E. Harrow's spellbinding debut. Step inside and discover its magic.
Okay, one take wonder. I'm impressed. All right, so Barry, what did you think?
I really like this book. I like the writing style. I like the, in particular, the word choices. And also the narration was top notch.
Okay. I also liked the book, but it took me two readings to get into it. There's some narrative discursion that happens that confused me the first time I read it, and the second time everything made a little bit more sense. I will say, if you find that the book is dragging, do hang in there. It does get better, and the various parts of it do intertwine.
It does have something of a slow build.
Yes, indeed. And I really liked the main character, and I liked her dog.
I liked the dog, too.
Yes.
The dog bad.
We're just going to be basically talking about the dog. Kevin, aside from it was there.
It existed, as far as I know. Yeah, I liked the book. I didn't like it as much as I wanted to like it, I guess would be the damning friendly way to say it or something. I'm a total sucker for portal fiction, so maybe my bar has been raised by some of the portal stuff we've read recently, but it's definitely not a bad book. And, you know, as I was thinking about it now for the recording, there are a lot of parts that kind of jump to mind that I go, oh yeah, that part was really good. I like this part and I like this aspect. So I think for me, there were a lot of scenes and aspects that I really, really liked, but it wasn't as cohesive overall as I would have hoped. So it's still worth reading, though.
Well, then it's time for us to open the door that takes us into the spoiler section. We shall return, for we are
SF3.
And we're back for our discussion section for The 10,000 Doors of January by Alex Harrow. First of all, there are large sections of the book which are a book within a book. Our main character, January, reading what I believe is her dad's journal or something like that. It's a story about her mother.
Right. It is written by her dad, and it's basically his story.
Mm-hmm.
But it leads into January's life and kind of explains it. But you don't know that up front, so it takes a while before you kind of grasp that it's not just fiction in fiction.
Right. And that, I think, is kind of hard to deal with when you're dealing with audiobooks, because there's not often the same sorts of cues that you might get on the page. There's no different typeface or anything else. Not that I know that that exists in the printed version of the book.
Or if you just tune out for like 10 seconds, you might miss that transition.
Yeah, exactly. At first, I was just like, okay, so there's this bit of narrative with January, and then we just go into this other story for a really long time. Why is this happening? And so that was my biggest problem with the book on my first read through. Second read through, when I actually understood where that book fit into place, then I liked it a lot better. And I'm not entirely sure that that's a flaw in the book. I think it's just a characteristic of this kind of literary device.
Well, it is true that in audio form, there's no like italics or whatever.
Right.
Thank God they don't like read it funny when it's in italics or something. on the other hand, when there are audiobooks that I've listened to that do try to duplicate why be like having like a little ding or a tone, that usually drives me absolutely nuts.
Yes. It may be a no-win.
I have to say I prefer just an appropriate pause or something. I've had audiobooks where there is no appropriate pause, and then it's very confusing.
So yeah, that was really the biggest impression that I came away with was, oh, this is much better than I initially thought it was. And I think that may be very much audiobook related.
So like we learn at the very end, you know, her father has found, you know, I forget what they were called in the Harry Potter world, but basically like those two cabinets that are linked.
Oh.
And so they share a common, you know, reference or something. And
their end points to a tunnel, right?
Yeah, something like that. Either they go back and forth or they share a common,
bag
inside or something. Yeah. And so, you know, he's basically this journal that she's reading is him trying to give his side of the story and give it to her. And so you also find out that, you know, things that she assumes that Mr. Locke, you know, the guy that sort of takes care of her, the big rich guy in charge.
Right. Also exploits her or tries to.
Right, right. But you find out that, you know, because she had gotten various presents that she found in this chest, she assumed that Mr. Locke had given them to her, and you find out, oh, it was her father that had done it through this magical chest. But of course, she wouldn't just assume, oh, he put it in this magical chest and I found it here.
I'm not even sure that I got this thing you're talking about. So
yeah, yeah. I'm not recalling it either, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah, they were very explicit about how it worked, but it was a very short description. You also get some information from, I think, I can't remember the character's name, but the evil vampire guy.
Mr. Locke's society buddy, right?
Yeah.
Right.
The Society of Evil.
I believe it was him that was saying that he was trying to get her dad, and like her dad was trying to hurriedly put this thing into the chest.
Oh, right.
And, you know, you say, okay, that's what happened on the other end, basically.
Got it.
And he sort of like, you know, derisively saying how what an idiot he was trying to like hide something in there or whatever it was that he thought he was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the book within a book, but yeah, it took a while to kind of understand what it was. The problem I always have whenever there's a book in a book is I think, is this a real book or not? You know, because it's not impossible that there would be a book someone had written about the history of portals and mythology or something, right?
I guess not, but I mean, this may be more of an you or possibly us thing that, you know, you hear about a book of portals to other worlds and you think, oh, that might be a real book.
Well, I think that's true. I would tend to believe that, but also I think more in the context of it being about mythology and not about real portals. There were parts of the books where it was like that.
Sure. All right. So moving on, when we were talking about this before, I think for all of us, one of our favorite characters was her dog, Sinbad, or Bad for short.
Yes.
He was the prototypical sort of bad dog, very badly behaved, and was only reluctantly able to not bite people and so on. What made him interesting, and are there other pets in science fiction that stand out in memory?
I mean, I have a theory as to why we tend to gravitate towards liking pets in books and TV shows and movies and things like that, is that, you know, we sort of envision them as like the ideal pet, right? You know, in our minds.
Sure.
All the characteristics you want in a critter that you associate with are automatically imbued upon this, you know, on screen or in your ear or, you know, on the written page environment, right?
And that made it sort of a little bit iffy for me because I have three dogs. And so the idea of a disobedient dog fills me with fear because there's three of them. Granted, they're very short, but still.
I'm trying to think of other fictional pets. You know, Ripley had, what was it, Jonesy the cat?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think also it just makes me think of this, you know, I've read these sort of like meditation technique books, and one, there's like this practice where you're supposed to sort of think good thoughts about different people or whatever, and they said sometimes, in fact for a lot of people, it's actually hard to think good things about anybody. And so they're like, but usually the love for a pet is much less complicated. It's a very pure thing usually.
Okay.
And so they're like, usually you can start with one of your pets and then move on to people after that.
Interesting. Okay.
Most people don't believe that, you know, their pets are intentionally trying to piss them off.
Right.
I do not have that lack of belief. There is at least one of my pets that I think is actively trying to irritate me, but that's fine.
What's the source of this pet?
Yes, that would be the Schnauzer. But anyway,
yes.
I don't want to embarrass her on a podcast in case she listens to it.
Wake up with a slipper full of goodness.
That could happen any day. Anyway, yes. So back to the book as much as we can. One of the things that I didn't quite understand was the limits to January's powers, because sometimes it seemed like she could just write down anything and then it happens.
Right. I think one definite limit is, you know, mana or something, where she definitely seems to get tired after doing something difficult, opening a portal or whatever. And she does other things that aren't opening portals, but that seems to be the primary focus.
Okay.
It's also the standard superhero problem of like, well, why didn't they just, you know, use magic power X and solve all problems in the book?
Yes. And I don't know if there are any formal problems in that regard. For example, through a lot of the books, she didn't understand what powers she had. She was under Mr. Locke's mental influence for a lot of the time, where basically he said, be a good girl to her. And since he was not just an ordinary person, but someone from another universe that could actually control people's minds, then you could definitely make an argument that she did not have full agency, and so couldn't just do whatever she wanted.
Is that like when you tell somebody to eat their vegetables and then they just eat them?
I mean, does that happen?
I kind of wish it would sometimes.
In which direction? Are you wishing that you could make people eat their vegetables, or are you wishing someone would make you eat vegetables?
Well, it could really be both, but it's mostly the former.
Yes.
Well, you were talking about the lack of agency, you know, for January, right? And I kind of agree, right? If Mr. Locke's powers are, even if they get invoked when he's not doing it intentionally, right, it could be kind of an ugly situation.
Right. And I'm pretty sure he was doing things intentionally, given who he was.
Right. There were certainly parts where, you know, he wanted her to do things. As an example, like, you know, sitting down at dinner, it's like, eat your vegetables. You're like, oh, okay.
Now, it seems that there's a lot of allegory taking place in this fiction, and I don't feel fully equipped to discuss it, really, but there's certainly the idea of somebody who can just create a door to another universe by writing. We call those writers. It seemed like there was a lot of very, I won't say it's heavy-handed because it's not, but it's sort of plainly written allegory.
Well, there definitely was that other, in the other world, writers did have that power.
Right.
And you kind of had to learn to control it appropriately and so forth.
Exactly. A lot of this is pointing to the power of imagination and the power of being able to think different things and changing the world. I think that there's also some stuff in here about colonialism because January is mixed race and Mr. Locke and most of his society is very Anglo. And so there's that going on. Is there anything else that seemed allegorical? Symbols!
I'm sure there is.
Okay, well, nope, we didn't spot it. We didn't spot it, so that means it's not there.
Exactly.
It's also been a while since some of us actually read the book, so
yes.
Some fine details may have escaped us.
Very fine details. But yeah, it seemed to me like the idea of carving words into your own body was definitely a metaphor for writing past writer's block.
That was an interesting scene in the book where she actually had to describe the door and everything that to open it while she was like a sanitarium or something she was got stuck in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After reading the book and then reading some other reviews, some other reviewers had noted that was a very cringy scene if the reader has done self-harm before. So that might be something for folks to watch out for.
Yes. However, we are way deep in the spoilers section, so this is way too late a warning.
Yes. I guess I didn't see it that way, but, you know, after thinking about reading the other reviews, I could totally see that point of view.
Yeah. Well, also, in context of the book, I think by that point she had read parts in the book about the tattooed people and the spells or whatever they called them. You know, they were essentially tattooing things that were essentially some kind of spell. And so I kind of thought of it more that she was tattooing herself, not that she was cutting herself.
Wasn't that like Julian's mother or something? She was the person who inscribed the tattoos on people.
Yeah, or the grandmother or something.
Maybe
I
it
think.
Was the grandmother. Right?
I think
yeah.
I think it was Adelaide's mother that was.
Okay.
In fact, that was one part I really liked was when she kind of comes into that power, because definitely part of the whole thing of like, well, why didn't she just do whatever she wanted by writing stuff down? You know, a lot of it seems to fall into the, you know, enough belief in yourself or belief that it will happen.
Sure.
And, you know, belief that the door actually exists and that kind of thing to help call it into being. So, you know, I think that was one big component. But yeah, I definitely like that one scene. I mean, all the scenes, you know, where she opened up doors, but the one where she sort of like makes one from nothing.
So yeah, what did we think about January as a character?
I actually felt she was a very powerful person. I mean, even outside of having that power, right? She has sort of like the spirit of never give up. You know, she may get knocked down for a while, but
she'll get up again.
Yes, it's a Chumbawamba song. I think I used the word indomitable.
You did.
Yeah, I mean, they basically call out that she's strong-willed in the book, and she definitely is, especially in light of what you learn at the end, you know, that Mr. Locke is basically this guy from another world that's this, I don't know, not really Klingon, but, you know, very brutal kind of hierarchy society.
Right, and it was brutal and hierarchical, but I got the impression that they sort of did psychic battle with mind powers, right? I mean,
yeah. Anybody that presents that power, which is only like a small percentage of the people, is sort of expected to challenge for leadership. And so it seemed like there's these small bands, and that's sort of his point of view is he comes to this world, you know, which is probably our world or something like it. And, you know, thinks, wow, this is like, number one, this is an awesome world for me to just kind of dominate, but also that it's a much softer, nicer place. And he's trying to, quote, protect it by closing all the dangerous doors that let, you know, ideas and things in and out to other places. So I guess there is definitely, you know, allegory kind of border control there.
Yeah, it seemed like they were putting the gloss on it that, well, we're trying to protect you from outsiders. But instead, right. They were actually just trying to keep anybody out that might be more powerful than them.
Yeah, it's a mechanism for holding on to power, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see this through history a lot.
Yes, sometimes I look at the news and it's just like, how would the world look if somebody had mind control powers? Well,
pretty much like it does now.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, favorite scenes?
I think the one that I mentioned, you know, about opening the portal with the tattoo. Also, I liked, you know, not a specific scene, but sort of the characteristic of objects from other worlds evokes the senses from that world. So like the book and
why are you dodging like, around the word smell?
I'm trying to be all fancy. Come on. I am an intellectual.
Sure. We can tell because we have a podcast.
And so the, like the coin, I think too, like, you know, smelled like the ocean or something. So I thought that was like an interesting touch that it wasn't, you know, it was something else that would identify these other objects.
Indeed. Barry, favorite scene?
I'm going to say it's probably a tie between, there's sort of like this long series of transiting between different locations once she learns that this society of evil men is following her. I kind of like that theme where she's jumping between, I can't tell if it was between time or just worlds or,
right.
It's really just between worlds, right? And, you know, depending on how they count time, it's a different time. So I don't know if that counts as time travel, but that's another discussion. The scene that I like was reading about, you know, like Julian and Adelaide's, you know, when Adelaide goes to, you know, live with Julian in his world, they describe sort of this city where writing and language are super important. And Julian is kind of a scholar in that field. And, you know, just the power that words give there. I really like that world setting.
All right. So now moving on to the usual questions. Was there tea? Apparently they did serve tea at Mr. Locke's. So, yay. Okay. What character do you want to be and or who would you be? Or which group do you want to or would you belong to? I took the liberty of answering for all of us that we would all be the dog.
Yes, Sinbad.
I guess I wouldn't mind having the door powers or one of the writer powers. But yeah, that sounded like it was also a lot of trouble too.
Yes. Possibly we could add another usual question. How would you use the properties of this universe to commit crimes?
That's just implicit.
Any way I can.
Well, let's see. Yes, if you could order people to do things and they would do it, that seems very obvious. If you could open a door to anywhere, that also seems fairly obvious. So kind of shooting fish in a barrel for that one.
So it's like having the Jedi mind trick and being a jumper at the same time.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, I don't have any pen or paper, so I'm just going to have to carve this in my arm. He writes an ending for the podcast and it ends. Anyway, so.
You mean just this episode, Ryan?
Well, maybe.
It was much more dramatic in video.
Indeed.
Yes. Well, until next time, we have been S.
F.
3.
Did you say B?
3.
This entire podcast has been an attempt to get a library of Kevin saying 3 a bunch of times.
This is a clever long game.
It's all different clever. Types of exhortations. And
first we lull him into just saying sci-fi a bunch of times, and then after a few years...
I'm actually just trying to get you to say my voice is my passport, but I haven't led up to that final step yet.
My voice... stuff.
Yeah, it's not easy work.
What was it? Recognize me? I forget.
If you like SF3, we'd appreciate it if you'd leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you leave podcast reviews. We'd also be very grateful if you'd support us over on Patreon at patreon.com/SF3podcast, where you can suggest new books or other topics for us to talk about. In any case, thanks for listening.